Before we move on, just a couple of points to tie up from last week's discussion. Also a question to address. First of all, just I want to say, Dovah B'Shem Oimre. Last week we discussed the force of the tradition. The way the Torah set the tradition up, that it should manage to go from one generation to the next in its most pure, unadulterated form, to be able to, in as broad a way as possible, go all the way. Right? We saw many mechanisms that the Torah set up to ensure smooth, unadulterated, pure transmission of the tradition from one generation to the next. That was said in the name of Rabbi Mordechai Neugershal. I didn't quote him last week because I forgot to. So I'm just saying in general now that many of the things also that we'll be saying here are from him. Even if I don't remember, I should try to remember. I don't always remember to cite sources. He has a very chush of a work on Khuzari, which I often draw from. Okay? So, in case I forget, I'm saying that in advance. Another just parenthetical point that I want to note, based on everything we discussed last week, is that when we realize the care put into conveying the Messiah in its most perfect form, we also have to understand another thing which has a lot of implications at all kinds of different points in history, including our times now. The reluctance of Torah leaders to acknowledge or accept any innovation in Yiddishkeit. For example, there are many examples nowadays of things that many Torah leaders resisted that have been introduced, whether in connection to the state or whatever it is. And it's often it's misunderstood exactly what the opposition is about. I'm not going to get now into the particulars of any of the examples. It's not what we need to be doing in this year. But I just want to say in a general way that we have to appreciate the reluctance, regardless of whether we agree with the innovation, we agree with the principles behind the innovation, but there will always be reluctance and resistance to in any form of innovation. I'll give a mashal. Based on everything we've been seeing last week about the care taken to preserve the smallest details of Messiah and the immense reverence with which we relate to our Messiah, I'll give a mashal. Let's say you're in a museum, and on one wall, you go down a hallway, and on that wall are some of the most classic paintings of all time. You have Rembrandt there, and Leonardo da Vinci, and Picasso, whatever other names there are. Did I get them right? Okay. And you walk down that hall, one painting after the next, and each one is an original classic. Right? There's the Rebbitzin, what's her name? Mona Lisa, right? And each one is a classic. You're walking down, you're impressed, nice paintings. And then you go over to the curator. Is that how you pronounce it? I'm a little not unfamiliar term. Turf. You go over to the curator and you say, listen, you have a great wall here of really good paintings. I like them. In case you're looking for feedback. Right? Rembrandt did a good job. I like that one. And then you tell him, listen, I have a neighbor who does beautiful stuff. I'm willing to arrange. He'd probably even give you one or two for free. You can stick them up on the wall too. How will the curator react? So, one minute. Oh, free of charge, no strings attached. Put it up on the wall. He's really good. I'm telling you he's good. Even if the guy really is good, the curator won't want to put him up on the wall. Not on that wall. Because when you're talking about Rembrandt, I hope I'm talking to the right caliber. Is he considered one of the greatest artists? Okay. Or you're talking about Mona Lisa. Even when you're talking about a person who's really a great artist and he has quality work. But one minute. Before you put him up next to Mona Lisa, he has to maybe get 500 years of history's worth of approval before you can put him up there. Right? You're slow to go and do that sort of thing. Or what happens if a really good artist comes and says, I want to make a little improvement there. I can make it look a little better. That's really what's behind the mitzvah's Torah of Baal Tosef. Don't add. You have a wall of classics. Don't add. Adding is subtracting. Here we mamish understand literally what Rashi says there on that pasuk. Adding is subtracting. Yes, if you take the best artist in the world today and put his painting up on that wall, you have detracted from the significance of that wall. You haven't enhanced it. How do we relate to the Rabbanans in this sense? So first of all, what the Rabbanans are, in front of that wall, there's those decorative protective things with the velvet, you know, going like that, from one post to the next. That's what the Rabbanans are. The Rabbanans are really just there to enhance and to preserve and to enhance, not in the sense of to improve. To enhance as in to enhance the preservation. To preserve and make sure that they're kept properly. To keep people far enough away from approaching. That's what the Rabbanans are there for. The exception to this is Hanukkah and Purim. Right? And the truth is that the Chachamim gave, and we see that they weren't quick to innovate these things either. Esther was given a hard time before they agreed to actually implement Purim. Until they decided that, yes, Itakum was up Yiracha Kodesh. So I'm just saying that as a general perspective on the reluctance to tinker with the Maseris at all. Even adding little things, there will be resistance to that. We have to understand that that's besides the whole issue of whether or not we agree with the motivations behind the innovation. People often take it as, oh, that means that you disagree with the whole principle. Not necessarily. The way the Chazon Ish put it was, when the proposal to have a day dedicated, maybe it was Yom HaShoah, I'm not sure. Whatever it is, to institute a day in memorial of the Holocaust victims, I guess that it ultimately developed into Yom HaShoah, I'm not sure. But I'm just using this as an example, again, I don't want to get into the particulars, but the way the Chazon Ish put it, Mamish said this, he said, we have to know our place in history. That's the way he put it. We have to know our place in history. We have to know, which is basically saying what we're saying, you're coming to add another day to the calendar given to us by Chazal. We have to know our place in history. And the way he put it was, putting it in my words, he obviously didn't say it in English, our generation would do best maintaining a low profile. That was the way the Chazon Ish put it. Again, not getting into whether it's a good idea, bad idea, it's true, it's not. Our generation would do best maintaining a low profile. Our glory is in managing to perform and maintain with utmost precision the beautiful Maseres that was handed down to us. That, I'm just giving that as a general perspective. You can apply it in any way you like. Draw whatever conclusions you would like from it. But it's an important perspective to have, if at least just in order to understand certain things that we see. Okay. The last aspect I want to address when we get to last week's subject was a question that Reb Noach asked. After everything that we discussed about how it would have been very, very difficult, to the extent that we already deemed it impossible, to introduce the Torah to the Jewish people in any other way than an actual revelation at Har Sinai, Reb Noach asked, what about the possibility that Moshe perform sorcery? Maybe that's how the whole thing happened. Or maybe it was all magic. So, as you pointed out in your question, we have to decide which track we're going with. Are we going to acknowledge the existence of sorcery? Or are we not going to acknowledge the existence of sorcery? We'll start with the possibility that we're not going to acknowledge the existence of sorcery just because we want to get that out of the way, because really we do. But if we're saying that we're not acknowledging the existence of sorcery, then to attribute it to sorcery, it's kind of the same thing as we said the other week, that would be the equivalent of attributing it to hypnosis. If we're assuming there is no such thing as sorcery, but you're going to have to innovate that there is such a thing as sorcery because the alternative is that there really was a revelation is too far-fetched, Then we could already say no. 3 million people are telling you they saw something. We're not going to write it off as, well, it was sleight of hand or sorcery. It, especially since we're not even acknowledging that such a thing exists. You're inventing it for this purpose. But that's not really... We shouldn't spend too much time on that because there is sorcery. There was sorcery. And the possibility should be addressed. But here we come exactly from the opposite angle. There was sorcery in those days. It's actually a machloikis kadmoni. The Rambam actually was of the opinion that there never was such a thing as sorcery. That's certainly not the general consensus. The way the Ramban puts it is, it's very hard to deny something people have been seeing all throughout history. But so there was sorcery for all practical purpose. What's that? Rambam basically says that all these things were illusions. That's basically what he says, and that's what the Chiyuv Mises is. Well, it's a long discussion, but you're right. You're right. We're talking about Gedolei Olam, but the Mefarshim already say that when you start looking at all the different instances where it comes in Tanakh, especially with the fact that in earlier times people really did have experience with that sort of thing, it's very, very hard to write it all off. The Ramban calls it over-piousness on the Rambam's part. And he was doing it. He was zealous. He was trying to say it. There never was such a thing. There was. That's the Ramban. But whatever it is, if we're assuming that there was sorcery, that means it was a phenomenon that they were familiar with. Especially since, like you're pointing out, Mitzrayim actually was the world center of sorcery. So, when you're taking 3 million people who grew up in Mitzrayim, you're not going to pull something over them as a world-shattering historic event by means of sorcery. Sorcery is an everyday event. Anybody can see through it. Anybody knows sorcery when they see it. So that's why, again, sorcery is not really an option. To be able to trick 3 million people who grew up in Mitzrayim, when sorcery was a common phenomenon in those days, it's like saying today with technology, you show people, today videos mean nothing, right? Videos can be simulated, right? Are you going to convince 3 million people? You convince one or two people, a few people, that something happened by showing them a video. If you're going to show it to 3 million people, and you really need them to accept it, you're definitely going to have a very nice bulk percentage of people saying, okay, so you put together a video, anybody can do that today and nowadays. If you're dealing sorcery in those days, that was certainly the case.
Maybe they were simple people.
What's that?
Maybe they were simple people and they accepted it.
So first of all, again, when you're talking 3 million, it's still a little bit of a stretch. Right? And again, it had to be every last one. That's A. B, even if you're talking simple people, again, these were people who grew up in the center of sorcery. Right? They were simple people, but they grew up with it all the time. Take the simplest person today and tell them, look, I'm going to do magic. You turn on an electric light. How did they turn light in here? In those days, sorcery was a very regular part of life. So you're not going to pull one over 3 million people by means of sorcery. And that's also besides the fact that we see that at the end of the day, the Jewish people were a skeptical people. They were not naive. You see, Moshe Rabbeinu was worried about that before he first came to them. And Hashem actually said that it's legitimate that they won't just buy things. And you see throughout the Dara and the Midbar that they gave him a hard time. They weren't just a gullible, follow the leader type of people. They gave him a hard time. If they all were completely bowled over, including Moshe's opponents, Korach, Dothan, Aviram, and all the rest of the Chevron, they were all completely bowled over by Matan Torah. That means that what they saw was completely beyond any shadow of a doubt. Okay, that really ends that discussion. Now, we'll continue with the Kuzari. So, what did the Chacham just come? He just came and presented a whole beautiful presentation how our faith is based on our tradition. Our faith is based on our tradition. Right? Our tradition is of such a force that it's as though we saw it with our own eyes. So now the Kuzari says, Omer HaKuzari. So now the Kuzari answers, if so, I have you against the wall. Because one of the most basic precepts of every religion is that every last human being must accept. Right? That's what Christianity preaches. That's what Islam preaches. That's what all the big religions preach. Now you, Jew, you just messed yourself up. Because according to what you're saying, There's no way to expect me to accept it.
Why is it necessary that a true religion remains a personal preference?
Oh, the truth is it's not necessary, and that's where we're getting now. Let's see.
No, what was the Kinsari's premise there?
What's that?
Well,
because that was such a the way it was with all religions, that's probably what religion means. Faith means that you believe that everybody has to accept it. Look, the Christians and Islams and then the Muslims killed millions of people based on that, what they consider an obvious precept. And if this is the truth, everybody has to accept it and live by it. So Amar Kuzari. So the Kuzari says, Im kenan yiroye sheteraskam eino nesuna kin lochem. Says, what comes out of what you're telling me is a big chiddush. You're saying that your Torah is actually meant only for you. Because you're saying that it's based on the premise that we all saw it, etc., etc. Vein chayv bazul aschem. Nobody else could be obligated by it. And here the Chaver shocks him with his response. Amar Chaver, Kainu. The Chaver says, that's right, exactly. Judaism is not a membership drive. We're not interested in gaining members. In this we differ from every last religion in the world. True. Well, the truth is, so do the Christians and the Muslims by today, when you're talking about keeping the frum ones. But right. We're not interested in members. This is something that has always shocked the guy. Guy approaches, wants to become a ger, gets a cool response. Thought everybody would be thrilled. However, the Kuzari says, however, any individual from among the nations who does decide to conform to our faith, he will receive some of the good that the Creator will give us, but he still will not be on equal footing with us. He won't be on equal footing with us. He won't be the same as us. Oh, what's bothering you? Oh, okay. Kuzari seems to be saying here that a ger can get schar, but he won't be the same as a Jew. And you're saying that sounds very strange. Okay. Let's put it on hold for a moment. We're going to get right to that. No. Good. Okay. He said, what? His question? Does it actually say the word ger? Okay, you already started the answer. Now,
what was the lesson?
Anybody who joins us. It does. Let's see. If the premise of the Torah is that he's the creator of the world, everybody would be equally bound by it, from white to black. Because they're all created by him. So he says, but no, that's not the premise of the Torah. The reason why we're bound by the Torah is because he took us out of Mitzrayim, and because he connected to us. Look at the political incorrectness of the Chaver. He says it straight out without beating around the bush. Because we are the prime of all people. Again, he wasn't trying to sugarcoat things. First of all, because he's not interested in gaining gerut. He's having an intellectual discussion. You want me to present my faith? I'm going to present it as it is. And also, because Kuzari himself is an intellectual. This is the faith. So he said it as it is. Hashem is only interested in us. He only connected to us. And why? Because we are the prime human beings. So now, Olam is surprised that the way he seems to be relating to a ger. So first of all, the way the Mepharshim take this is, and we'll see indications of this, that he doesn't mean a ger. He means someone who conforms to our faith, as in a guy who acknowledges the truth of our faith and is willing to live in conformance with that as it applies to him. Meaning, a guy comes and says, you know what? I see that you folks are right. What does Hashem want from me? He's not becoming a ger. This is what we call a ger toisha. What? What's that? This is what we call the sheva mitzvahs bnei noach, ger toisha, chasidim l'sa'olam, all the other expressions we find in Chazal for righteous going. Yes. They can join, but now we well understand that this is not such a big chiddush that he's saying that yes, a righteous guy will get tzchar, but he's certainly not going to be on the same footing as the Jewish people. A ger, a person who becomes a ger, a person who actually becomes a Jew, he's now connecting to what the Jewish people are. He's now like all of them. We're also ger. We'll see, though, how exactly the process worked with this. Okay. Now, Omar Kuzari, so what does the Kuzari say to this bold statement? Remember how the process went. In the beginning, the Kuzari was not impressed with the Chover's presentation. Then the Chover explained himself, and the Kuzari said, oh, there's something to that. And now the Kuzari says, whoa, I see you reverting back to your original state. He says, your words are now becoming pathetic again after they became profound. So the Chover is starting to lose his patience. He said, 1 minute, we had a deal. You're going to be quiet and listen, and I'm going to talk. Stop interrupting me. So he tells him, hey, don't let me start sentences without finishing them. Bein raza bein shami, whether my words are pathetic or profound, harchev li libcha, open your heart for me, acha farish yosef, until I explain. As we say in modern English, listen, let me talk. Amar Kuzari. So the Kuzari says, Emor Masha Tirtza. Alright, say what you like. In other words, fine, I accept. So let's understand what's bothering the Kuzari. The Chaver comes along with a statement that Hashem is interested only and exclusively in the Jewish people, doesn't need anybody else to join. The truth is, we have to realize that this, he's starting from the Aleph base. This is the second most fundamental principle in the Torah. The Torah basically has three lessons. If you want to divide the Torah into the three most fundamental themes, what are the three most fundamental teachings of the Torah? A. Hashem, who Hashem is. B. His choice of the Jewish people. And C. That the Jewish people's connection to Hashem is through the Torah and mitzvos. Those are the three themes of the Torah. So therefore, the Kuzari is really starting with the most basics. We introduced Hashem. Now we have to get to the next step. The next most fundamental aspect of Torah, whether it's palatable, whether it's politically correct or not, is the absolute and exclusive choice of the Jewish people. And he's adding, because they are the prime human being. In other words, and this is what he's going to come to defend now, what he's saying is, really, what Chazal said. We are not just the chosen people. We are a different species. We're a different species. We're a completely different creature. We look the same as Goyim, but it's the same as a matchbox car can look exactly the same as a Lexus. But the two are not at all the same. And now he's going to explain it. So now the Chaver explains. And he's going to build it up slowly. We're going to have to bear with him. Let's note, how do we classify existence? B'dinayin HaTivi, we know in a very basic way, the way we have it in Jewish literature is existence is classified into, in the most broad form, Doimin, Tzomeach, Chayim, Medavim, right? There is inanimate, not just inanimate, mineral. Then there's plant life, then there's animal life, and then there's humanity, mankind. Now the truth is that that's already a chiddush. There we're already diverging from the non-Jewish understanding of it. When we say that we are the choicest of people, we're actually being more generous with the goyim than they are with themselves. How do they view humans?
Part of the animal kingdom.
Yeah, part of the animal kingdom. There are three levels. There's minerals, there's plant life, and there's beast. Man happens to be the most intelligent. Okay. So, actually I had a biology teacher. Imagine this is what I was taught in the walls of a yeshiva. I had about 4 months, half a year of high school education. One of the gems that I learned in biology class in the yeshiva was a biology teacher who told us, actually, now, according to certain studies, we're starting to wonder that perhaps the dolphin is actually more intelligent than the human. This is something I learned in yeshiva. It's a good thing I got out of that yeshiva. I don't know how many more yeshivas they're learning that in. But maybe dolphins are actually more intelligent. So maybe even the premise that the human... What's that? Now that would be a compliment to him. So, actually, maybe the premise that humans are the most intelligent of beasts is not either true. Yeah, that's why dolphins are performing for us in aquariums and we're not performing for them. But whatever it is, no. The human being is a completely different being. A guy too. Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem. It's not the same as beasts. Man is a completely different form of life. Nivra B'Tzelem. There are very different levels of Tzelem Elikim, and there are a lot of different aspects to it. The most profound aspects are only shaykh to the Jewish people. But Kohim also have a Tzelem Elikim. The fact that they have an intellect. There are a few different manifestations of the fact that any human being, there are different human characteristics that completely set him apart from animals. Conscience, for example. Conscience is a manifestation of Tzelem Elikim. It's a manifestation of the human soul, which sets it apart from animals. No animal has a conscience. Not gorillas, you'd say that they're the step before human beings. They don't have any form of conscience. Right? You ever see a gorilla relate not nicely to his wife and then he feels lousy about it? There are different manifestations of the fact, just in looking at human characteristics, Goyish people, of the fact that a human being is a completely different species. But that, at least in earlier times, before mankind sunk to unprecedented levels of stupidity, in earlier times, the Goyim also agreed with this, that mankind is of a completely different kind. So now the Chavar is going to start breaking down existence. Bedina inyin ativi, when we're going to talk about life, meaning the most basic form of life, plant life, let's start defining the different requirements of different levels of life. We're talking about the most basic level of life, meaning plant life, and up. It requires nutrition, vagidul, it requires growth, right? These are the defining characteristics of life, even vegetation. Vailada, reproduction. Nikachoisam v'choltnayim, and many other respective properties and conditions that they require. But these are the most basics, right? They require nutrition, they grow, and they reproduce. Now, v'syached b'zeh atzemach u'balechayim i'baladei adama. This is what sets plant life and animal life apart from earth. This is what sets plant and animal life apart from earth and from stones and from all the other minerals and elements. So we have our first distinction in forms of existence. Amar HaKuzari. So the Kuzari answers, the king. Of course, this has to be elaborated on more. Aval emesu. But it's true. Amar HaKuzari. Now the Chavar says, okay, now let's continue developing it. Well, be'inyan an-nafshi, then you have what he calls nafshi. Life. Living life. The next level, after plant life. Isyachdu balichayim kulam. The next level is the level that all animals have in common. Benishchayvu mehem. What are the characteristics, the defining characteristics of the next level above plant life? Tenuos. Movement. Vachafatsu. And desires, umidos, instincts, chushim, senses, nirim v'starim, some of which are more obvious, some which are less, betavos, lusts, mizulasele, and other such things. So these are things that characterize the next form of existence, animal life and up. Amar HaKuzari, so the king answers, okay, gan ze mevor ein derech l'tchoisot. This is also clear. This is not debatable. Omar HaChover. So the Chover continues. Ubedin Ha'inyan ha-sichli. Now we move on to the next level, what he calls sichli, which is really what we might call human. This is already a different form of existence, not the most intelligent of beasts. That's always defined as the medaber, the speaker. Speech is what expresses the intellect, which is what sets us apart from animal life. And we see that some of the requirements of this level of life, that's already above animal life, is you have to control yourself. Tikkun HaMidos, just translated to Broadway, is controlling yourself. Animals, in order to have a successful life as an animal, never need to overcome an instinct. They follow their instincts through life, and they have a successful life as an animal. Once an animal starts going against its instinct, it's headed for failure. Man, on the other hand, and this is another manifestation of the fact that man is a different form of life. In order for man to really succeed in life, he will have to overcome his instincts in many situations. Right? Let's talk from a completely non-religious point of view. I'm not talking religion. Atheists have come to the realization that tikkun hamidos, that improving your character, overcoming urges, and holding back when you're tempted to do something, holding back when you're provoked, is likely to get you a lot further in life. Right? Becoming a better person. Or, today, very, very widespread, learning to relax, learning to take things easily as a means for a better life. All kinds of aspects of character improvement which a person needs in order to be a successful human being. And yes, for example, a person who wants to be a successful human being can't live for the moment. There's no animal that can't live for the moment. Every animal can just follow his instincts. They have instincts sometimes that are also planning for the future. Right? Ants have an instinct of hoarding things away. Fine, but you can follow your instincts. A human being who follows his instincts will never go for a higher education. It's long term, not gratifying, costs money, inhibiting. What for? Well, the answer is, there's a long term plan. Sometimes you have to put off what you want. You have to overcome your instincts. This is another manifestation of the fact that, yeah, the very fact that you see that for a human being to be successful in life, he has to work on improving himself, that sets him apart from other forms of life. Note again that this is a completely different category. You don't have anything like this in other forms of life. V'amoy, they require homes. V'amedina, they require society. Ushan, hugis, v'nimusim, v'nhugim. They require all sorts of other behaviors that animals don't. Omar Kuzari. The Kuzari says, Gamze emes, that's also true. So, he agrees meanwhile with the Chover's breakdown of forms of life. Now we're getting to the touchy part. What's the next level after human? So, Omar HaKhover, Ve'ezu madurega ato choshev l'malo mizos. What would you say is the next level after human? Omar HaKuzari, so the Kuzari says, Malas HaChachamim HaGdol, the wise, the intelligent, philosopher, right? We saw that. Intellect is a choshev thing. Omar HaKhover, the Khover says, no, that won't work. You can't define that as a separate form of life, because can you have a wise person born from a stupid person?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you have a stupid person born from a wise person? So it's not a different being. It's just
wise.
Exactly. That's right. And also more than that, why intelligent person simply means that he has a little more of what the other guy has a little less of. It's not that you have something that the other guy is completely has nothing to do with. So Chava says, anyway, it's a loymar elomalo tafridis baleo treda atzmis. Don't tell me intelligence. Don't tell me wise. I'm asking you for an inherent difference between you as a being and him as a being. Ki poreda tzemach min adoimen, bi poreda odo min abehema. I want you to tell me the next level above you, human, above man, in the same way you differentiated between plants and stones, and in the same way that you differentiated between man and animal. Once you're going to start differentiating between more or less, let's say you're going to tell me that wise person is a different form of life, where do you draw the line? How wise? Right? The spectrum goes, IQ is a long, how wise? Where anybody could arbitrarily draw the line and say, well, here marks the difference between the lower form of life and the higher form of life. If they shipeg the mikris, they namala derech haemes. It's not an inherent characteristic. It happens to be that you got a little more intelligence where he got less. He has better developed muscles where you have worse developed muscles. But that's not an inherent difference. So Omar HaKuzaris, the Kuzari says, you know what? You're right. Im kein eimala b'mugoshim yisera al malas neov. If so, you're right. There is really no apparent level above mankind. Mankind is the top. It doesn't break any further. So the truth is, what he's getting it as at is that no, actually the Jew is a different form of life. But he wants to prove it in the Kuzari's language. So he says, what? In the Kuzari's language. Meaning, let's actually show characteristics that that distinguish you as a different form of life. So Amar HaChover. So the Chover says, "Im yimatzei adam sheyavai be'esh velo yuzak." Superman. Okay? Is Superman a different form of life? Let's say you have a person who can walk through fire without being harmed. And he can go for a long period without food, without being hungry. And his face shines in a way that you can't look at it. He never gets sick and he never deteriorates physically. Meaning, the way, unless a person dies young, grows older, starts deteriorating physically until he runs out. Right? But let's say you see a person, it's not like that. Goes straight like a locomotive. When it's time for his end of day dies, what does he do? Looks at his watch, ooh, time to die, lies down and dies. Runs through life vigorously till it's time to die. When it's time to die, he lies down of his own accord and dies. At a specific time, at a specific hour, he knows that at 11 o'clock it's time to die. Now this person also knows everything about the past and about the future. What was and what will be. Now, what will you say about such a person? Is this a different form of life? Would you say that this is an inherent distinction between him and mankind in general? Theoretically, meanwhile, Superman. Omar al-Kuzari, so the Kuzari answers, yeah, Aval amar lo azois, this description, Elokis malachutis, it's godly, it's angelic, if there is such a thing. Meaning, yeah, if you'll find me such a person, I'll tell you, this is a different form of life, this is an angel-like being, this is a god-like being. You're right, that's already not just another form of mankind, that's already a more divine being. It's not just another instance of mankind. You can't classify him with man, nor with animal life, nor with plant life. That's already a more defined being, it's a different form of life. So the Chover says, that's what the Jew is. Anybody here walk through a fire without getting harmed? Well, let's see. What's that? You're Avram. But, so okay, but if we're just going to draw on Avram, what does that say about us? Let's see. So Amar HaChov. So the Chover says, Eile kitzois ta'orei ha-Navi shalom. These were some of our Navi's characteristics. Moshe Rabbeinu. He basically described Moshe Rabbeinu. Avram Avinu was the one who went through the fire. But all the other things, we go through them again, briefly, we'll note that it's all Moshe Rabbeinu. Went without food, right? Had a face who shone. never got sick or weakened. Right? It says at the end of the 120 years, it says on the day that he died, so eyesight wasn't weakened. Had all of his vigor with him. He died because Hashem told him to die. Right? Hashem told him, Moshe, time to die. Go up to the mountain and die. And Moshe said, okay. And he also knew the past and the future, etc. This is a description of our Navi. Asher nireh al yadoy lahamoyin ischabruz hadavo elekiveh. Now, here we have to note. So Shkoyev, you showed me a Navi. There was such a person once in history. Okay? Where do you get from there to saying that the entire Jewish people are like that? So the answer is, this is actually what he's going to be saying now, Moshe Rabbeinu, was he able to skip food at any given time? Let's say 40 days he was on Har Sinai, skipped food. When he came down after that, could he decide to go a week without eating? Probably not. There's no reason to assume that he could. Right? He ate mon like everybody else. What was really behind all these different qualities? It's not that this was a person who had all these qualities and that's what defines him. Really, these qualities were just manifestations of the fact that this is a person who is bound up with Hashem. That really is the distinguishing characteristic of the Jew as opposed to the others. The Jew is connected to Hashem. We'll put in the Nefesh HaChaim's words, and we'll see how the Kuzari describes it, just in order to explain what we mean when we say that it's a different species. A non-Jew is physical. He's got a certain level of Nefesh, as we discussed, but he's physical. Made of earth, goes back to earth, and that's that. Right? Goyei ha'arotzos. Lo'yosonu ki goyei ha'arotzos. He didn't make us like the nations of the land. Nations of the land means they grow out of the land and they sink back into the land. That's how all of life is. That's what plant life is. That's what human life is, right? Grows out of the land, sinks back into the land. The Jew looks the same as the Goy, but it's the other way around. The Jew really, you're seeing him from bottom to top. Top to bottom. Really, a Jew is radiating down from the sky, coming down, 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 down from the sky, and ultimately culminating in earth in the physical body that you see. But the physical body that you see is really, the way Nefesh HaChaim puts it, the shoe of who the Jew really is. You have to look at yourself in the mirror and realize that. The physical body that you see is the shoe of who you really are. Meaning, there's so much more to you that you're not in touch with right now, because in this world, we're not meant to be in touch with all that. Give a mushel of what it's like. You have a person who's put on this general anesthesia. The only thing they leave not under anesthesia is his small toe. That's the one thing he can sense right now. You pinch his toe, he feels it. You punch him in the stomach, he doesn't. As far as he's concerned now, his entire existence is his little toe. Right? So how much of himself is he conscious of? Nothing. Right? That's us in this world. Where we don't begin to be conscious of who we really are. You know what the neshama is? We're conscious of our body. A very small, tiny, all the way at the end, at the bottom, the shoe of who we really are. Now you understand that we and a guy are completely different. A guy, what you see is what you get. The body is what he is. That's the guy. Made from the earth, goes back to the earth, and that's that. You see that, yes, on the outside, the two look the same. But it's only a very, very superficial look. We're talking about two forms of life. Could become a Jew. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. We started on that earlier, but we're going to leave that for now. Right now we're talking about the inherent difference between a guy and a Jew. Well, he's a guy. Now, so really, what the Chavar is saying is, all these things that we saw about Moshe Rabbeinu, right? We saw him defined by, characterized by things that clearly set him apart from mankind. Go without food, never weakened, face that shone, etc. Ashenir al yodoy la'amoyin ischabrus hadavar elikibahim. Really, what was the significance of Moshe and all of these phenomena? And really, what was his message to the Jewish people? What was Moshe's whole koyach? Moshe's whole koyach was that for Hashem, he represented the Jewish people. what he, his message, what he was showing the Jewish people was, what did he demonstrate at Sinai? How Hashem connected to all of them. How Hashem connected to all of them. We have Hashem attached to us, and that's what sets us apart from all the guys. And that's what Moshe was showing us. Showing that we have an Hashem who is directly and intimately involved with us, and that He guides our affairs. He guides our affairs to directly reflect our state in His service. Meaning, He's always going to act with us in accordance with how well we're conforming to His will. V'igid lehem anelo. And yet, He informs them of the conceal. V'idiyai chayachidu sho'ilam v'yachas b'nei adam kodem ha'mabuch. And through Hashem, through Moshe, Hashem informed the Jewish people of all the world events. He informed them of how the world came into being and of the whole lineage of mankind from the first man before the Mabul until afterwards. He provided them with the exact lineage of how they go back to Adam HaRishon, exactly how the Mabul came about. This is all part of tradition, by the way. How all of the 70 nations ultimately stem from Shem, Cham, and Yefes, B'nei Noach, the children of Noach. Ve'ach nifridu al shoynes, how all the different nationalities spread apart, right? Originally, all of mankind was one concentration. And the Torah tells us exactly how it developed into different nationalities. That was the Tower of Babel, right? Ve'ich shachnu, and where the different ones settled, and how the nations that we are now familiar with, meaning, I don't mean America and England, but I mean the nations of ancient history that we are familiar with through our studies of history, through our archaeological studies, etc., the Torah tells us how they came to settle in the places where they were, how these different cultures and nationalities developed. Moreover, the Torah goes and tells us how different trades developed, how different skills developed, right? Metalwork, etc. Ubinyan Hamadinas, Ushneo Oilam Eodam Adot. It tells us how states developed, and it also tells us exactly the amount of years from the time of Adam until our time. So I just want to note what he's really saying here. Why did he get into this whole tangent? He was on a subject. He got into a tangent. He was on the subject of discussing the supremacy of the Jew. Right, and now he got into all the different facts and figures that Moshe gave us from Hashem. The truth is, what he's doing here also is again bringing home the point of the uniqueness of the tradition, that, of the Torah tradition that we have. Nobody else could dare, especially at that point in history, to come and venture to explain to the world, really to present to the world, a record of how all of history developed, if it wasn't true. Right? And coming and saying that in the not such far off past, this nation developed this way and that nation developed that way, giving an exact record from father to son. We have to realize that the Torah covers the entire history. Right? All of the generations from Adam until Matan Torah is not that many generations. The Torah gives an exact record, also describing how all of the well-known nations of the time came into being, who they came from, etc., etc. That's not something that can go uncontested if it wasn't the absolute truth. So again, he's showing us the veracity of the Torah that we have, and he's saying that the truth is, that is what we received from Hashem through Moshe, and it was the phenomena that we saw by Moshe that show us what it means. What was really behind all those phenomena? Again, the fact that Hashem was connected to Moshe, and we're all connected to Hashem in that way. So even though we don't have necessarily have all the symptoms, but the inherent factor in distinguishing Moshe from all of mankind was the fact that Hashem was connected to him. And that, Moshe showed us, is not just his exclusive status, it's something we all have. And it's that connection that distinguishes the Jew in an absolute way from all the rest of mankind.